This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And so much news today. We'll get to the flooding in the South that's been so deadly and devastating. But let's begin with the feds. It's the feds in a shootout with soccer's global governing body, the untouchable, up until now, FIFA. Swiss authorities arrested several top officials gathered at their annual meeting in Zurich on charges of federal corruption. The charges were backed by an FBI investigation and alleged widespread corruption in FIFA over the past two decades, including questionable practices in bids for World Cups and marketing and broadcast deals.
They were expected to uphold the rules that keep soccer honest and to protect the integrity of the game. Instead, they corrupted the business of worldwide soccer to serve their interests and to enrich themselves. This Department of Justice is determined to end these practices, to root out corruption, and to bring wrongdoers to justice.
Call for justice there from U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, speaking at a news conference earlier today. Swiss prosecutors have also separately launched a criminal case into the bids for the 2018 World Cup to be held in Russia and the 2022 World Cup to be held in Qatar. Sepp Blatter, FIFA's longtime president and the man who has a bullseye around him for many football fans, was not charged. Joining me now with more is Andrew Jennings, investigative journalist specializing in corruption in FIFA and author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Andrew, you are right in the middle of all this, right?
So it appears, John. So it appears. And what a laugh listening to those liars from FIFA telling you it's good news. They've been caught. Well done, the feds.
And what documents are these charges based on? And have you seen some of the materials in this investigation?
Well, I gave the feds quite a lot of documents in recent years. They've gone very quiet for the last couple of years because I know it's been at the grand jury. But I basically gave them the documents initially, which got Chuck Blazer from New York, you know, the supersized liar who didn't pay tax, stole from FIFA and from CONCACAF, and who is a cooperating witness, you call them in the States, yeah? I gave the feds, because I've been talking to the feds for years, and then I realized that Blazer was just disgusting. So I gave them internal documents from regional football. Blazer rolled over within minutes and became a cooperating witness. His last email to me said, "As a journalist, you are useless." So I knew we'd got him.
Yeah, we can see how useless you are with those Swiss police there in Zurich. Let's talk a little bit about what happens with these charges and the questions that many football fans are raising about revoting for the events in Qatar in Russia. FIFA says there will be no revote. How do you reconcile that?
Who cares what FIFA says? These are statements they're going to make from the dock before going down the stairs. Of course, they say this crap. What you must understand, if I may say, is that FIFA has been corrupt for a very long time, going back to the mid-1970s when the mobbed-up João Havelange from Brazil took over. Later, he hired Blatter as his bag boy to run about. And reporters like me, and none in America, I'm sorry to say, have never been interested, in Brazil, in Germany, in Switzerland, we've worked together and we've amassed masses of information. So, and I know it's been with the grand jury for a long time, which is good news because the feds have been tested on the quality of their evidence. But what this means to you, to your listeners, is I think you're going to be hosting the World Cup in 2022, because we now know that they're investigating the Russian and Qatar awards. Well, some of us have been for quite a long time, but obviously they have as well. So it's going to have to come out of Qatar for a whole range of reasons, including the crooked vote. And you may recall America won second. America's very good at logistics. You could probably put a World Cup on next week if it had to. So I think it's going to come to America and it's going to come out of Russia as well.
All right. Well, let's look at this final issue here then. Sepp Blatter is seeking a fifth term. He could be elected on Friday. If he is elected, is there any move that the international community can make to just decertify FIFA altogether and cut off the head of the beast?
Well, the crucial thing is we laugh. just keep laughing when you hear their PR men, like he said today, everything's all right. Blatter will try and get re-elected on Friday because he can't get an election on Friday. It will never happen. But he'll be elected by purchased votes, people who had development grants, World Cup tickets. It'll be a joke. It's down to Visa, McDonald's, Coca-Cola to say we're not dealing with these bums anymore. We want a clean soccer organization.
So it's up to the sponsors to decertify FIFA and to really change this.
It's time New York Sunil Gulati, who runs American football, actually said something. He has a nice, comfy life at FIFA on $200,000 US plus more every year and is silent. They've nicked his colleague Jeffrey Webb, who's president of CONCACAF, the area in which you're in. Well, he's now in chains in a Zurich prison. Will Sunil resign? He never said anything, so let's get rid of him. It's for your fans to do it, mate.
All right, Andrew Jennings, investigative journalist specializing in corruption in FIFA and author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family, on all of the developments today on the soccer governing body. Andrew, it's always great to talk to you.
Cheers, mate.
Now the story of a story. We take you deep inside Syria, where there is fighting on all sides, something we report on continually on the program. But with the benefit of our colleagues at Vice News, we can see how the fight is going against Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. That's a rebel from al-Nusra talking about atrocities committed by the Syrian regime, soldiers in the northwestern city of Jisr al-Shagur taking that city. Vice News managed to embed with the opposition fighters as they took control of the town, and their filmmaker Salem Rizik got a firsthand account of what the struggle was like. Now posted to Vice's website. Jihadists versus the Assad regime, Syria's rebel advance, is a very special piece of journalism. And Kevin Sutcliffe, head of news programming for Europe for Vice News, joined us to explain how it was made.
Well, Vice News has been covering the Syrian conflict since we launched last year. We've got extensive contacts with the rebel groups, and we've been in and out on a number of occasions, films in Aleppo, filming with some of the bigger jihadi groups like al-Nusra. Recently, we noticed that these groups, particularly the Islamic groups, had stopped fighting each other, and they were starting to form a coalition. And this coalition, which is a very wide-ranging coalition of Islamic groups, the Islamic Front, al-Nusra, who are an al-Qaeda affiliate, and the FSA, a much more moderate but and US-trained group, had come together. And they were starting to push the Assad regime back and making quite striking gains in northwest Syria. So we reached out to the group to see if we could get in with the filming on the ground as they were moving across the northwest Idlib province.
And the documentary that you produced is mostly in Arabic, which is an indication of just how far embedded your journalist, and his name is Salem Rizik.
Yes, Salem, who's worked with us on a number of other projects, was able to reach out to some of those groups to be invited in to show what was going on. And we've got a very up-close view of this. It's a very difficult film to make. And Salem, I think, has to be applauded for the way he went about a very brave piece of journalism.
So the context of this is, here is the fighting in this town, Jisr al-Shagur, and here is an opposition soldier with your embedded journalist who is saying, I'm a descendant of Muhammad and Umar. If the mountains disappear, I will not be eliminated. God is the greatest, celebrating some measure of a partial victory. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I came across a number of fighters who were very excited that they'd taken this territory. I mean, what we were interested in was this new coalition, because it's got moderates and it's got Islamists in it. It's got US-trained groups in it, and it's got al-Nusra, who are al-Qaeda. So this group, which I think has come about from political expediency and is making great ground across this province, the Saudis and the Turks are the main players behind this. Before, they were both backing different groups. And now they seem to have come together, and they've all come together to try and bring the regime down. And that's why we're interested in getting in here, to find out what this new development was all about.
And here's some of the passion against Bashar al-Assad. This is a civilian woman and her family who were shot on camera leaving Jisr al-Shagur. Now, from a hideout outside the city, she's telling your producer, may God take Bashar al-Assad's life. He is Iranian and the son of an Iranian. He is the one who has stranded us like this, made us leave our homes. He destroyed our houses. We have nothing left. Now, that really begs the question, are these fighters that your producer is embedded with doing the work of the United States in fighting Bashar al-Assad? Or on some level, are they doing ISIS's work by toppling Assad and making it more easy for ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, to take territory and turn on these rebels?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. And I think you'll find that Nusra are no friend of ISIS. In fact, they're fighting each other in other parts of Syria. I think what's happened, though, and this is looks like a political fix, is that this faction, which has got so many different elements to it, as I said from before, with the US-backed and armed part in the FSA to the al-Qaeda groups, this group is in the ascendancy. But what's more interesting underneath that is that the real power here is Nusra, al-Nusra. So what you're seeing happening is that Nusra are establishing themselves across the Idlib province, and they're starting to look towards pushing towards Aleppo, Latakia, which is the Syrian regime port, and Hama. So what we're seeing is a growth of an al-Qaeda influence in this area. It's not doing ISIS's work. They're actually growing their own influence. They're very strong and very powerful. So what you've got is a coalition that at the moment is holding together because it has one aim, which is to get rid of the Assad regime. But I wonder if that works. This coalition doesn't look like it would hold together very long because of the wide range of differences within it.
Without putting anyone in danger, Kevin, before we go, do you have a code to indicate in communications with your producer, Salem Rizik, whether he's in danger, whether he needs to move, whether he's at risk of being a hostage?
Well, as you know, we are the organization that made the Islamic State film, and we've made many of the films that are in very difficult to report places, and we've got protocols in place for managing the safety of all our camera operators and journalists. So, you know, rest assured that we don't set out on these projects without knowing full well the risks, how to manage those risks, and also how to keep our journalists safe.
Well, I'm excited to see the full version. And Kevin Sutcliffe, I appreciate your candor. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Nice talking to you.
Kevin Sutcliffe is the head of news programming for Europe for Vice News. He spoke to us from London. And you can watch the full Vice News documentary that we've been talking about. Just visit thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
First, Congress said no on immigration reform. Then the president said yes to granting benefits to some immigrants and outlines a series of executive orders to take some immigrants out of limbo. Now a federal appeals court says no to the president. The Fifth Circuit decision shuts down the presidential orders that would have given millions of undocumented immigrants work permits and offered protection from deportation. Joining me now for more on what all this means is Denise Gilman, director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School. Also with me is Laura Collins, the director of immigration policy at the American Action Forum. Laura and Denise, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for having me on.
So what has this court done, Denise?
So the district court, the lower court, had issued a preliminary injunction halting the DACA and DAPA programs, the administrative orders, and the appellate court has simply said that that injunction will stay in place so that the programs will not be implemented at the moment, but it is not a decision on the merits.
And is it a question of who has authority here, Laura Collins? Is there any sort of comment on whether the president is permitted to do this independent of, you know, certain protocols that they ruled against the president on?
Well, as Denise said, this wasn't on the merits. So while the opinion does get a little bit into a little bit of the issues of whether this is an appropriate program or not, ultimately, this is just a pause button. And until the court is able to rule fully on the merits of this, this doesn't really talk about whether this program is appropriate for the executive branch to put forward.
Now, I'm looking at this, and a lot of Americans are looking at this. This is a Texas plaintiff, I believe, and there were other states that signed on to this case. And there are plenty of states that signed on or at least issued amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, opposing this decision. Is this an example of a politicized judiciary basically doing one side's work for it in the courts, and that there's a court that will eventually rule in the other direction? And this has to end up at the Supreme Court, Denise?
Well, I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I do think that the federal appellate courts, for the most part, try to engage the legal issues in a very analytical manner. But it clearly is an issue that has multiple facets to it and that is very complicated and controversial. And so there is a decent chance that in the end, the case will end up in the Supreme Court. But we're nowhere near that at this point.
What is the future for the millions of people who now suddenly have a lot of seemingly worthless paper sitting on their desks?
Well, that's the real issue here. And unfortunately, it's not even quite that, in the sense that most of the individuals who would benefit from the executive order have not received anything yet, have received no benefits because of the pause button, as it was described, that was put in place by the lower court. So really, this decision is just allowing that pause to continue. But it does mean that many, many individuals, maybe as many as 4 million, are in a state of limbo, wondering whether or not they are going to be able to work lawfully and to integrate more fully and to contribute to the economy in a more stable manner. And so in that sense, it is very disconcerting for the many people who are waiting to find out whether the program would be implemented soon.
Laura Collins, would you say that that limbo is an appropriate state for these undocumented immigrants, or that there should be some clear indication from the federal government of what's going to happen now?
Well, I think ultimately, when you talk about the undocumented population, they constantly live in this state of limbo. And this executive action didn't really change that. Even if it were allowed to go forward at this point, that doesn't really change. They get a temporary reprieve. You're looking at only 3 years. It's something that the next administration could come in and strip away. And so I think a legislative solution is something that's much more stable for these people. I think these immigrants deserve the opportunity to earn legal status and to prove that they've been here for many years because they want to be working and contributing to our society. And something like an executive action that is can be so temporary is not the ideal solution for them.
So are the dreams and the dreamers null and void at this point, Denise and Laura, before we go?
Well, it's important to know, first of all, that the original program, DACA for Dreamers, for young undocumented youth, is still in place. What was really in question here is the expansion of that program and the extension of the program to parents of citizens and permanent resident children. So for the original Dreamers who benefited, they are still very much able to work and to contribute to our communities. The question is really for the expansion of the program, and it is a shame that we haven't been able to make more progress more quickly in implementing the administrative orders.
Final thought, Laura?
Oh, well, I don't mean to be dire, but there's not been a lot of movement in Congress, and I think a lot of that goes back to this executive action in November. There had been some momentum, and congressional Republicans warned Obama not to do this, that it would take away their momentum because they didn't trust his actions, and that's where we are now. Now Congress has moved on to other issues, and so I think that absent some more movement in Congress and absent some more cooperation from the executive branch to get a legislative solution, there's not going to be a permanent solution for these people very soon.
Laura Collins is the director of immigration policy at the American Action Forum, and Denise Gilman is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School. Denise and Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. It's a ghostly prospect, writing in a voice of someone who is dead. But then on a day when we explore how our imagination has essentially merged with our computer software to create illusions of relationships, as well as enhance real relationships, it's not so outlandish to be asked to write the next novel of the late Agatha Christie. Sophie Hanna is a veteran mystery writer and was authorized by the Agatha Christie estate to write The Monogram Murders, the first authorized Hercule Poirot mystery to be published after Agatha Christie's death. This year would have been the 125th birthday of Christie. In the run-up to Christie's birthday in September, the writer's estate is asking her fans to vote on their favorite Agatha Christie novel. And of course, we want to know what your favorite Agatha Christie novel is, so head over to thetakeaway.org to cast your vote. And don't be intimidated by Hannah here. She's been an Agatha Christie know-it-all for a very long time.
I had read every book Agatha Christie published by the time I was 14. My dad bought me my first Agatha Christie when I was 12, and I absolutely loved it and said to him, please buy me all the others, because he used to go to second-hand book fairs quite a lot. And by the time I was 14, I had a full collection and had read them all, and I've read them about two or three times again since.
So what degree of crestfallenness must have come over you when you got to the end?
Actually, I don't remember feeling, oh no, I've read them all now, what am I going to do, when I read them the first time. Now I'm rereading them all probably for about the fifth time.
Oh my goodness.
And I am now feeling scared of when I finish, because I just enjoy them so much. There's no other writer whose books I just sort of purely enjoy to such a great extent. And I'm sort of thinking, when I finish rereading them this time and I'll know all the plots, I'll have remembered all the solutions, what can I read next that will be as much fun?
Well, I'm not a big Agatha Christie fan, but I loved And Then There Were None, which is Ten Little Indians.
Yes, well, that's her, probably her best-selling and most popular book. And if you love that one, you would love many of the others, if not all of them.
All right. Well, that gives me something to do. And I loved Orient Express.
Yes. That's another of that. That's probably her cleverest solution to a mystery.
Really?
Yeah.
So the estate wants fans to vote on their favorite Agatha Christie novel.
Yeah. So this is this new project, World's Favorite Christie. Mm-hmm. And if anyone wants to type those words into a search engine, they'll get to the site and you can vote on your favorite Christie novel. And what they've done is, they've asked various writers and actors and famous people to sort of nominate a book each. So I'm there on this World's Favourite Christie site suggesting that people ought to vote for After the Funeral, because I like to make life difficult for myself. I don't think there's the slightest chance After the Funeral is going to win. Mm. I think the winner will be either Orient Express or And Then There Were None. Those are Agatha's, you know, most famous.
I'm so mainstream.
And best loved books. But I chose After the Funeral because I think it's just at the right point between simple and complicated. Some of Agatha's novels are, you know, so simple, a 12-year-old like me when I was 12 can absolutely love them and, you know, get everything out of them that there is to get. And some are so complicated that when I read them now, age 43, I have to sort of think, right, I really need to make notes as I'm reading this denouement, otherwise I'll never be able to get it all to fit together. And I think After the Funeral is just at the right sort of halfway mark. It's just complicated enough. It has this wonderfully dysfunctional family, and several different branches of the family all get together at the beginning to hear the reading of the will of, you know, an elder member of the family who's died. And just the family dynamics are so well done. Agatha was brilliant at dysfunctional families, and this particular one in After the Funeral, I think, is probably the most subtly dysfunctional of all.
You know, it makes you want to set up categories for a subsequent contest.
Well, I do have these categories. So when people ask me what my favourite Christie novel is, because I find it so hard to choose one favourite,
right,
I have categories. So I say, you know, best all-rounder, that's After the Funeral. Best mystery and solution combination, Murder on the Orient Express. Okay. Best murderer character, the murderer in Lord Edgware Dies is, I think, Christie's most terrifying and fully realised killer character. Best dysfunctional family.
I was thinking of that when you were talking.
Well, there's a family in another Poirot novel called Appointment with Death, which is possibly even more brilliantly drawn than the one in After the Funeral. It's this family where there's a matriarch and several grown-up children, and the grown-up children are terrified of their mother to the point where they can't go against her on anything. You know, if she says, no, we won't have another cup of tea, we'll leave now, they have to obey her. And everyone who observes this family from the outside cannot understand why these grown men and women are kowtowing to this tyrannical old lady. And the grown-up children can't explain it, because, of course, what's been going on is, ever since they were born, they've been psychologically brainwashed and groomed to believe that if they displease this woman, terrible things will happen. Now, that is a real
dysfunctional
family dynamic, which you only really know about if you've experienced it. And Agatha was writing about this in, you know, early 20th century, before such things were sort of fully recognised. So, I mean, that has to be a best category of some kind.
Best unconsummated love interest novel.
Oh, that's interesting. Best unconsummated love interest. Yeah, no, she was quite good at making sure people who ought to get together did get together. Mm. Poirot often finds time in the middle of solving a mystery to point out that two people who love each other really ought to do something about
it. All right, so best consummated together. Love interest.
There's one in Sad Cypress that's very good.
Best Christie with a church.
Oh, Murder at the Vicarage, the first ever Miss Marple. That is a brilliant novel. In fact, that would have to be in the top five Christies. Okay. But I say that about so many. So often I go, that must be in the top five. And before I know it, I've got 17. So, you know, it is really hard to choose the best ones.
Most laughs, Christie.
Oh, that might be The Moving Finger. The Moving Finger starts off in a little village and poison pen letters are being sent to everybody, and then murders start to happen, and people think the murders might be linked to the poison pen letters, but there's quite a few hilarious moments in that.
I think it's
the vicar's wife in that book is such a character. She goes round just saying the most appallingly direct and slightly offensive things to everybody in a way that's just hilarious. So I laughed a lot at that one.
Well, Sophie Hannah, this has been delightful. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sophie Hannah is author of The Monogram Murders, first authorized Hercule Poirot mystery to be published after Agatha Christie's death.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Mandarin, mobile app development, and mindfulness. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Your computer is a piece of yourself. It's your music collection, your photo memories, notes to yourself, an archive of who you are, the record of everyone you've ever contacted, what you said. We think of our networks as social, that's what they're called, but are they? We expect our interactions with the computer to imitate something human. There's Siri.
How may I help you?
Who you either love or who just creeps you out. There are the imaginary cognitive operating systems that think they could become your friend, a very close friend in the case of the movie Her.
Theodore, how long before you're ready to date?
What do you mean?
I saw in your emails that you'd gone through a breakup recently.
I've gone on dates.
Well, then you can go on one with this woman. And then you could tell me all about it. You could kiss her.
Samantha.
What?
I can't believe I'm having this conversation with my computer.
But this is not so far-fetched. For thoughtful people, our computer interactions are all human. A user interacting with a coder. Is there a way to be a part of the low-tech software innards of our computers? Nathan Schneider says yes, and it's as simple as knowing the people who create the computer environments we use. This journalist and thinker compares this approach to computing to the difference between fast food and slow food. Norman says, ditch Google and Facebook, create a server network with other people, and the cloud becomes your cloud. It's like knowing where the food you eat comes from.
The slow food movement really started out with a fascination with experience and wanting to recapture that kind of old way of relating to food rather than cans and fast food. What actually came to be through the movement was a recognition that this was about more than aesthetics. It was about community. It was about how we relate to the people around us, how we build economies around us. And that's actually something that I've been discovering in my encounters with slow computing. Some of the tools that have really stuck with me, for instance, are the text editors that have been under development for decades now. What I use to write with most of the time is something called Emacs, which was first developed in the 1970s. It does everything that I need it to do, and I found it to be an actually superior tool than, for instance, Microsoft Word in many respects, because it, again, it brings me closer to the text, and it also puts me kind of in conversation with the decades of developers who've been building this.
So your social network is the other programmers who helped make the language, and the superior part comes from the fact that you're closer to the computer, so therefore you can do translations much easier. You can go from one format to another in Emacs much more easily than you can do it in Microsoft Word.
Yeah, one of the things that you notice about tools like this is that they were built out of need. Whenever the next version of Microsoft Word comes out, you know, it's built to serve a very specific commercial purpose. It's built to make a profit for Microsoft. And you can tell that the tools that go into each sequential version of Emacs were built by people who are using it, less a commercial need than a personal need or a community need. And that makes a real difference.
So it's like WikiText. Everybody's trying to work it out together.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the challenge now is to try to translate this process into the internet, into a moment where more and more of our lives are on the cloud. More and more of us are dependent on tools like Gmail and Dropbox and Google Docs.
Now, you've made a stab at this. You really experimented with how you can create an alternative cloud that works just exactly like the regular cloud, but it has some features that you would never expect from a impenetrable, opaque kind of server.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's really striking as you start building a kind of community-based internet, a slow internet for yourself, is you have to do it differently. You have to relate to people differently. You know, I work with an organization of which I'm a member called May First, and a lot of my cloud services are hosted through an open source program called OwnCloud. And often that means that I'm interacting with those people. I'm interacting with the people who are managing the server. I'm interacting with the developers of OwnCloud to see what's coming up next, to see whether new features are possible that I can see a need for.
So how does that work exactly? You'll be doing something, you'll be downloading something, and somebody will pop up in a little text message and say, hey, Nathan, is this your file here, this big, huge file? We wish you'd make it smaller using this program.
Well, normally it's me reaching out to them. Uh-huh. And there's a whole practice for how to do this in open source software development. For instance, one files a bug report. You know, when something goes wrong with an open source tool, rather than sending it to the company and having the company hide it and protect it from being seen by anybody else where it might affect the company's valuation, in open source development, those bug reports are public. Anyone can see them. And therefore, the whole community joins together and tries to solve the problem together. So it's a very different approach to problem solving than what one finds in proprietary software.
Do you ever solve a bug?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah. Often what happens is, you know, I'll submit something. Either I'll get a reply about, okay, if you just tweak this here, that'll fix the problem. Or, you know, somewhere down the line, maybe the next version, maybe two versions down, there will be some kind of solution.
Now, I have plenty of stuff stored in Google's cloud, and I have no idea where it is. But you, on the other hand, know exactly where your cloud stuff is.
Yeah, actually, it turns out that the servers are located in a building not far from here in Lower Manhattan.
And you could go and talk to the people who run them and...
Yeah, absolutely, to the extent that I like. You know, these things require a bit more patience to learn, a bit more patience to solve some of the problems. But one of the things that I realized that kind of surprised me was that the glitches started to feel different when I started relating to software this way, when I started using more and more open source tools. They felt less like a moment of frustration before some big company that I have no control over, but they began to feel like an interesting challenge. Oh, there's something going wrong. You know, how can we solve that? How can we go about putting this right?
So it's not some technological death force that's ruining your life. It's a collective of architects building a building together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a real challenge right now to expand that collective. Right now, open source software development is very white, very male. it's built a culture that has kind of enforced that and created boundaries for people.
What about these two young people who created this social network around the Ferguson unrest and who really mobilized an entire kind of civil rights movement?
I think that's a great example. One challenge, though, is they're relying on a lot of the closed systems like Facebook and Twitter that many of us continue to rely on. My question is, how much more powerful could a movement like this be if we're not dependent on services that are really fundamentally designed to deliver advertising?
So tell our listeners what they could do, like right now, with their computer to bring up the command line and search for something that would give them a taste of exactly what you're talking about here.
The most important thing, I think, is to take it one step at a time. You know, to try one tool at a time, to just play around. And there are a few places one can go to learn more. For instance, alternative2.net is one that I use a lot for just entering in commonly used commercial tools and then getting a list of alternatives. But to me, the most important question is how we're relating to each other, whether we're building business models around the online economy that really support people flourishing. We get a lot of stuff for free, but the price we pay is often surveillance, advertising. I think it's time that we start asking really hard questions about that and experimenting with building business models that do things very differently.
Nathan Schneider is a freelance journalist. His article in The New Republic, The Joy of Slow Computing, talks about all of what we've been talking about and a lot more. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Think it's all fun and games and calm, cud-chewing Ben and Jerry's cows up there in Vermont? No way, folks. A nice woman was nibbling some fresh grapes and got bitten by a black widow spider. Worst case scenario for this 21-year-old. But the deadly widow just made her a little sick, hurt more than a little, and she spent a night at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Turns out black widow spiders aren't really that scary. That's all for today, but you can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. I thought they were the worst. I thought they were deadly. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Black widows really don't matter? This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.